This is a recording of Chuck Morse and Marina Citrin debating the life or death of the anti-globalization movement. They spoke at the 2004 Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference at Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, on September 24, 2004. The quote-unquote anti-globalization movement that erupted onto the scene in Seattle 1999 frightened elites and inspired activists around the world to fight the system in a utopian anti-authoritarian way. However, this movement has occupied a much less significant place on the public stage since the terror attacks of September 11, 2001. Is it over? The two panelists offer differing responses to this question and continue a dialogue begun in the spring issue of the journal Perspectives on Anarchist Theory. Chuck Morse lives in New York City and works with the Institute for Anarchist Studies. Marina Citrin has worked with a number of global justice organizations, from helping to start the New York City Direct Action Network in 2000 to initiating and participating in various activist legal collectives over the past few years. In this two-part recording, we also hear from many other activists and organizers about this and related matters.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chuck Morse, and this is my co-presenter, Marina Citrin. Thank you very much for coming to our workshop. I know I speak for both of us when I say it's a privilege to address you. As you know, the title of this workshop is The Life or Death of the Anti-Globalization Movement, and it's a continuation of a debate that Marina and I had in the previous issue of Perspectives on Anarchist Theory. This is the new issue, but it's the previous issue, which is much smaller and looks different, which is the biannual publication of the Institute for Anarchist Studies. In that issue, we were invited to respond to the following question, which I'll read to you right now. We are in the anti-globalization movement. The anti-globalization movement that erupted onto the scene in Seattle, 1999, frightened elites and inspired activists around the world to fight the system in a utopian, anti-authoritarian way. However, this movement has occupied a much less significant space on the public stage, since the terror attacks of September 11th, 2001. Is it over? Marina and I offer differing responses to that question, and it appears that the question and also replies to it provoked a lot of interesting discussions and dialogue. So what we'd like to do is continue those dialogues today, and hopefully through the collective experience of this workshop, deepen all of our respective appreciation of the unique juncture, historical juncture, in which the anti-authoritarian left presently finds itself. So that's the goal of the workshop. Thank you very much for coming. It's great to see you all. Concretely, what's going to happen is my esteemed comrade and debating partner.
Esteemed now.
Yeah. Often esteemed comrade and debating partner will speak for 8 minutes, in which she will offer her opinion on the matter. I will speak for 8 minutes after her, in which I will offer the correct analysis.
Correct.
Oh, oops.
Already made our arguments.
Oh, oops. And then we will both offer 2-minute replies to one another, and then open the floor for discussions and commentary. So we're really looking. I'm really sure we're both really looking forward to hearing your comments and discussions and responses. So without further commentary, I present to you my occasionally esteemed comrade, my greatly esteemed comrade and dear friend, Marina Citrin.
Excellent. Can I use your watch there?
Yes.
I'm going to kind of do time, and then when we have the conversation, I'm going to help facilitate the conversation, because we're not going to do question-answer like that at all, because people here have experience, I'm sure, in all kinds of different movements and have all kinds of ideas about all of this. So, and also, it might shift a little bit. I might speak less than 8 minutes. Chuck will speak probably 10, and then I'll probably just come back on. We talked about this, actually. This was agreed upon before, and then I might say a few things after that, and then we'll go back to the group. Okay, so it's 8:25. And what was I going to say? I was going to start out saying that the goal, I think, is discussion, and discussion both about the ideas and where are we going, what are we doing, both theoretically and practically in our various movements that I think are a movement, and I think, yes, it is alive. I don't know if people read the piece in Perspectives. It also sparked a bunch of people writing, both online, kind of responding with ideas, questions, putting out more ideas, and then in Left Turn magazine, other people wrote of their experiences, again, addressing kind of where is the movement, and a little bit of where people think we should be going as a movement. Just to get a sense already, who here considers themselves in some way kind of part of a global justice movement or a movement of movements. Kind of like a... Okay. Just getting a sense. I wasn't going to let go. But, okay. One of the things, and I guess in thinking about the question when we started discussing, and I opened the piece this way as well, and the perspectives is what... The first thing that I thought about with this question of is it dead, and looking at a movement, is it alive, is it dead, especially kind of the power of what happened in Seattle particularly, which is what's put out in the question, which I'll get to in a minute. But I think already it's a problematic way of approaching the question. And one of the things it reminded me of is I actually spent a lot of the last year in Argentina doing work on this oral history book that I'm doing of the autonomous movements. And when there was the rebellion in Argentina, so many people were inspired. A lot of people continue to be inspired. But some people then, a year or so later, you know, kind of this popular rebellion happens, and a number of people look at it and think, okay, there's a new power being created that's going to get rid of state power altogether. And when that didn't happen, and that different kinds of creations are happening, and I would argue different kinds of power are being created, but some people, including kind of well-known people, James Petras, Naomi Klein, looked back on that experience and said, the movements are kind of dead. They're over. And I think that's a problematic analysis, and I think it's a similar one that is being articulated around the global justice movement. And that movements are dynamic. They're not stagnant. So it's not, you know, and it's easy, I think, to look at something really inspiring, and you put on that your dreams and your aspirations and what you want it to be. And then when it doesn't become what you want it to be, then it doesn't exist anymore. And I think that doesn't help us as much in our analysis and in looking at where movements are that we're a part of. I also want to address just briefly, there's not a ton of time, but this idea that the movement started in Seattle. And I know the question doesn't say that exactly, but that in many ways, both globally, and a lot of people thinking about Chiapas and movements that were taking place and are taking place in South Africa and in India, different kinds of anti-capitalist movements, some focusing in different ways on institutions of global capital, but definitely anti-capitalist and having similar ways of organizing, had been taking place all over the globe and in different ways in the United States in different movements. So Seattle wasn't a thing that just happened. It was a lot of people coming from a lot of different movement histories, from anti-nuclear experiences in the 80s and 90s in the U.S. and the solidarity movement, radical parts of the labor movement, all kind of coming together to make Seattle happen. So in looking at it as well, it's not kind of an eruption, but a kind of all of this came together and erupted in a way, but not in a spontaneous boom. This just happened, that there's a history. One significant thing, though, that I think did happen in the U.S., particularly from Seattle and in thinking globally, is in the past, a lot of work that was done internationally and our allies around the world kind of looked at us in the U.S., but I guess I could put Canada in there, too, as I look and see a whole lot of folks from Canada. As kind of people in radical movements here doing solidarity with. And I think that did change. And I think around the world, people started to look at us in this movement as kind of fighters, shoulder-to-shoulder kinds of fighters and more serious anti-capitalist fighters also trying to get rid of our government. And I think that did change. And briefly as well on, I guess, some of the things that I think this movement does have that is alive, this global movement that is anti-capitalist. Some of the things in common are not just anti-capitalism, but I think a new way of looking at power. And the concept of taking power is no longer something that most movements that consider themselves kind of part of this global justice movement are considering in the same way, and rather are creating other kinds of powers. Also, the language that's been used a lot recently and kind of was coined in the 60s, this idea of prefigurative politics, so that what we're doing now is about the relationships that we're creating now, and what we're doing is very much a part of what we're creating. So kind of putting the future into the present, and not just we're fighting for this. This is, again, linked to the idea of power as well, but we're not just fighting to someday have this better world and have better social relationships, but to make them now in our relationships, seeing ourselves more as actors in the now. I also think there's a change in the way we look at not just resistance, but again, kind of creation. This is linked again to prefigurative politics, but not just that, kind of thinking about how the work we're doing is creating something different, not just in our relationships, but in structures and parallel institutions and things that we create. So some of the things in the U.S. that inspire me and where I see this are things like indie media, or in activist legal collectives, or in medical collectives. You know, these parallel structures we set up to build our movement and take care of one another. And this can be seen in different ways in different communities in places around the world as well. Specifically, I'm thinking about Chiapas in Argentina, but in other places as well. Another difference in why it is a movement and continues to be is this, that there continues to be this desire to create and not to create kind of a program or, you know, a party or an organization kind of the left in the past, that I think that's a break in a new kind of politics now. One thing that Chuck argues in his piece, and that we've all thought about, and I think it would be useful to talk about in this discussion as well, is the role of September 11th in all of this. So there's this massive movement, particularly, you know, we're talking about the U.S., there's this prefigurative global movement, but in the U.S., not talking about taking power, but creating the future right now in our relationships and in our social creation. And then September 11th happens, and how does that affect the movements? And I would argue that it absolutely did not end the movement. I think our movement changed, and movements do change. And you can see some of these changes in different ways. Some of it, a lot of people who are involved in targeting only corporate institutions, or predominantly corporate institutions, are also focusing on the idea of empire and are anti-war. But not just, okay, now we're just anti-war. We're anti-war and we have a corporate analysis. Also, all over the country, groups started that were anti-war groups on different campuses in different towns to an extent that still, I don't think enough research has been done to know to what extent, but teeny towns all over the U.S. There was a study that was done in Mother Jones showing that there were more protests and kind of activist hotbeds organizing than in 1968 after the war started. And something unique to that, and that is still part of the movement, is the way in which people were organizing. People weren't just organizing, okay, you're the president of the group, when are we having the protest? But we're organizing in a way that was consciously non-hierarchical, that was about this kind of idea of prefigurative politics. And this is all over the U.S., and I think that is a marked thing. I've also been in a car for like 8 hours, kind of driving here a little. That shows the life and the vitality of the movement because the way it's affected all of these new groups. And something that I was thinking about, David and I were talking about this in the car on the way up, and like, okay, what's a concrete example? And part-time, I kind of teach at NYU, and there's a class, a tutorial on anarchist theory that I did last semester. And in talking with a part of the syllabus was to talk about the Zapatistas and the role of the Zapatistas. And I saw this as a huge part of the discussion and a part of kind of this break from the way people did politics in the past, people, the revolutionary left. And was talking about it in this framework of a break and difference until kind of a lot of people are looking at me kind of blankly. Okay, what am I missing? What's happening? And folks were like, well, a break from what? What was different? And so these are people who are kind of late teens, early 20s saying, well, how else would you organize if you didn't do it horizontally? If you weren't prefiguring your politics, what other kind of relationship would you have? So these are people who are activists and are thinking about it in a way, but a fundamental change in the way people think and relate and organize has taken place over the last number of years and is still taking place, which is part of what makes it the movement. Some people did withdraw from politics and some have gotten back involved and not because of September 11th. A lot of people, and this is also something I've learned through having this wonderful opportunity to exchange with people who were in their teens and early 20s, so a lot of people were radicalized because of September 11th, which I think is, rather than September 11th ended a movement, a whole bunch of people have become radicalized, and what I've heard from folks is, well, the government must not have been telling me what was really going on. So people actually from fairly traditional families and backgrounds saying, this thing happened, why did this happen? The U.S. must be doing something around the world that is different than what I've been told the U.S. government does. And then started to become not just questioning, but then becoming active, and again, becoming active in different groups that were trying to create a future in the now. Another significant thing in the global justice movement, in how it's shifted since September 11th, but shifted, not died, but changed, and I think actually deepened in a lot of ways. And it's something that Aura and RJ in this piece they wrote in Left Turn talk about in their experience becoming active around protesting the World Bank and the IMF in Washington, and that was their first big protest. And then after September 11th, how did things change for them? And what they started to do more was get involved in their communities. And as much as folks had been talking about this in the movement, there is, for different reasons, kind of an opportunity in some ways because certain space was closed, but it also opened space for other kinds of possibilities or for us to act on other ideas that we had. More community-based work, I would argue, is being done in the last few years. And some of that was reflected if you look at the mobilizations in Miami and in New York. So in Miami, with the Root Cause March and a lot of community-based groups participating in the Root Cause March, as well as, again, kind of sections of left labor or part of people who consider themselves in one way part of the labor movement. And these folks consider themselves part of the global justice movement. And I think that's significant. The Coalition for Immokalee Workers, when I was talking with some folks just recently at the Life After Capitalism conference, identify as part of the global justice movement. They don't call themselves anarchists or anti-authoritarians, but they see themselves as a part of this global movement. How these groups as well, different community groups related to one another, kind of learning from how we've been relating to one another in the global justice movement, kind of seeing themselves as a part of it and relating in a way that's more a network style, a network way of organizing, not creating some monster hierarchy and some big coalition, but rather relating in a flat, horizontal way, again, the kind of network idea, which is part of the movement as well. And there's really not time to go into the whole argument around the global aspects, where Chuck's arguing that that folks in the movements in Argentina don't consider themselves part of the global justice movement, or people in Chiapas don't consider themselves part of the global justice movement, or in Brazil and the landless movement. And I don't agree with that. It would take a lot of time, I think, and I'm running low on it already, to go into all of those specific movements. But just from my experience in Argentina and from folks from Argentina who've come up, they consider them, people I've spoken to, consider themselves part of the movement. It might not be exactly the same, so that when we were in Cancun and there was someone there from Argentina who I was spending time with, or tons of people from all over the world, the media was talking about the protesters as the English translation is like globophobes. So it's like anti-globalization people, globofóbicos. I don't know, what do you, that's like globophobes. And so on the one hand, Martin, who was the person who was there from Argentina, from the movements, was saying, well, you know, kind of, I'm a globophobe, meaning me, and he's part of the movement. But I'm part of the movement as well. It's like a sub-part of the movement. I'm not sure exactly. We didn't have the conversation, but I think as well that people all saw themselves as part of the movement, but the globophobes maybe meant a specific, I don't know, the people cutting the fence or something. I'm not sure who exactly it meant. So there might be subtle distinctions, but seeing ourselves as part of the same movement, I think that's key. And just a last quick point, and I would never want to argue that our movement or any movement is determined by police tactics. But if the movement were dead, you would think the police wouldn't be so interested. And before Miami, the New York Times had an article on how there's this big investigation of the links between the anti-globalization movement and the anti-war movement. And we all know, having participated in different protests, the kinds of repression that's taken place, whether on the street or more recently, it's becoming more and more, you know, that I have a few number of friends who were picked up by federal agents or police in New York, not arrested, picked up, interrogated, harassed. The infiltration has become in some ways more obvious, which is a disruptive technique that the police do. And I don't want to go into a long discussion either about that, though I do think it's something to think about, is how do we deal with this is a big question. But if the movement weren't a movement as well, I don't think they would care as much. So I guess I'll turn it over to Chuck. I have a number of questions that I think would be good for our discussion that we can talk about as well. I guess my hope, though, in the conversation is to talk about, you know, is it dead, is it not dead, but also how do we think about movements in general? Are they live things? Are they not? Do they die? And if they die, how do we recognize that they're dead? And I think that's a really useful conversation. But also, I guess, especially we have this privilege of starting first before this whole weekend, to kind of start thinking concretely as well, or continue thinking concretely and doing it in a collective way about, well, what are our movements? Where is the movement? What are we doing? And how our theory relates to the movement. So thinking kind of concretely about our experiences and our dreams and desires and everything for the movement. That's it.
Well, you know.
He's going to share his water, so.
You know, I mean, I don't know where to begin. No, just kidding.
You could just discuss.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I certainly appreciate Marina's comments very much, and I think they're very insightful and or instructive for me. I have different things to say in reply, which I'll say for later. If I don't go over my 8 minutes, 11 minutes now. Is the anti-globalization movement dead? I'm of the opinion that it is. And as a result, that anti-authoritarian activism now exists on a different terrain than it did 3 or 4 years ago. I think the landscape has shifted, and it's important to appreciate that shift in the landscape in order to make sure that our activity as anti-authoritarians, activists, anarchists, whatever, remains sensitive to the challenges and needs of the times. In thinking about the anti-globalization movement, I want to make 2 points that frame my comments. The first thing is that the capitalism is a contradictory social order. It's an antagonistic, contradictory social order. So people always find a way to resist capitalism and have always resisted the social order of capitalism since it appeared on the horizon. It's not eternal. It emerged historically at one point, and people have always found a way to say no. Social conflict is an integral and permanent part of a social order which tends to reduce people to things and to market values, tends to reduce nature and people to market values. So social conflict itself is pervasive. It's an eternal feature of the social order. What was distinct, in my opinion, about the anti-globalization movement, and what I think is distinct about all transformative social movements, is that it found a way to bring deeply embedded contradictions and potentials in the social order out into the open and to make people conscious of them in such a way that people could act on them and respond to them. It took these contradictions that existed, that were deeply embedded, and helped masses of people collectively respond to them. So when I say that the anti-globalization movement is dead, I'm not arguing that resistance to capitalism is over, certainly not, nor that particular groups have folded. That's not really the point. But rather that a particularly sharp moment in the long conflict between people and a social order that is antagonistic to people and the planet has passed. A moment of conflict has passed. The struggle continues, but its forms change. So that's my argument. I just want to get that clear at the outset. What I'm going to do for the remainder of my talk is talk about why I think the anti-globalization movement was unique, about its trajectory and its reasons, the reasons for its decline and as I see them. I think understanding these things, wherever you fall in the question at hand, is important to grasping an important moment in our shared conflicted history. So when I refer to the anti-globalization movement, what I'm speaking of is the movement that emerged in Seattle 1999 at the protests against the WTO. People correctly point out, and Marina emphasized this, that the movement didn't just appear out of thin air in Seattle one day. And I think that's right to point out. I think that's correct. However, I think the movement was distinct and marked a new, entered into a new trajectory in the history of anti-capitalist resistance. And I'll talk about why I think it was distinct from some of the movements which preceded it, such as the Zapatistas, for example, who have also resisted global capitalism. The movement was unique in part because it was politically oriented against the institutions of global capital per se, whereas prior movements such as the Zapatistas are politically oriented primarily on the relationship between their national states and the global economy. For example, in the San Andreas Accords, which were accords devised between the Zapatistas and the government used to negotiate a truce in, I guess, 1996, the demands in the San Andreas Accords of the Zapatistas refer to the Mexican state. That's what they're making demands upon. Whereas the anti-globalization movement mobilized against things like the World Bank, the WTO, the IMF, and other pillars of the global economy. So I think a new political focus emerged in the long history of dissent. The second point I want to make is that I think that its political culture was unique. In my opinion, the movement that emerged in Seattle was applicable to any or almost any post-traditional Western society, such as those that exist in the United States, Canada, or Western Europe. It was not particularly American, specifically American or Italian or Canadian per se, but rather much more general in my opinion. Whereas the political culture of the Zapatistas, for example, has everything to do with the specific experience of indigenous people of that region and cannot be and has not been transplanted to another region. It's very particular to that area, in my opinion. And finally, the movement had an overwhelming emphasis on tactics and strategy, much more on how we protest rather than why, and I think that was something unique. So with those three points, I think that a new movement emerged in Seattle in 1999, although it had precedents, I think it was new. And I think the movement was particularly well-suited to draw out underlying contradictions in the social order because of two aspects of its political culture, because of two aspects of its identity. One is critique of capitalism. Its opposition to global capital was built on a deeply moral opposition to the reduction of people and nature to saleable objects, and in that sense resisted the very logic of the market economy. I don't have time to get into contrast between other formulations of the anti-capitalist critique on the left, but this was really unique. It was a very moral critique, and thus ran up against the logic of the market economy. Secondly, its emphasis on participatory direct action encouraged a profound ethos of direct democracy, and as such tended to contradict the political structures upon which the nation state is presently founded, particularly representative democracy. So it was well suited to make things explode, okay? And it did. From Seattle on, the movement threw itself headlong into a conflict with the architects of the global economy, as I know you are all aware, and provoked a unique confrontation over the course of world affairs, a unique confrontation in the history of capitalism. The summit protests were, of course, the main activities, and for years these protests, time after time again, illustrated the deep contrast between the cruel, profit-driven world of the global capitalist and another world, premised on a joyous affirmation of life or a party in the streets. It illustrated these contrasts for all the world to see. And even the violence that erupted at protest after protest was instructive, an important part of the project, for two reasons. One is the cops illustrated our point about global capital by cracking heads. You know, they're walking propaganda machines. You know, you can make an argument all you want about, you know, capitalism being linked to the state, but when they're, you know, beating heads for people exercising their constitutionally protected right to assemble, it's pretty easy to make that point. So they were walking propaganda machines. And secondly, the sight of major European and North American cities in flames seemed to suggest to me, and I think to other people, that a new world was being born, and that out of the ash, that from the ruins of the old world, a new world would emerge. It seemed to say that the old world was burning and then a new one would emerge. To me, it felt that way. So amazingly, the system, the anti-globalization movement, had polarized the debate about the future of the global system and raised some of its deepest contradictions into public discourse. And that's an accomplishment, a big accomplishment. And it not only indicated an alternative, but actually helped to create one by expanding our global discussions and by reframing our global discussions about the course of world affairs. It's pretty significant. You know, it brought new people into discussions of the nature of our social struggles, social structures, and it reframed them. So it was pretty significant. And for a moment, it seemed like the world could and had to make a choice between a world for profit and a world for people. That is how I felt, nonetheless. It was a very exciting moment, and I would identify the high point of this conflict as occurring between the Seattle 1999 protests and the protests in Genoa, Italy in 2001. However, this is one of the ironies, is that the movement's very success prompted it to confront a vital question upon which its future would hang. Specifically, if global capitalism must be abandoned, if you're against global capitalism, then what do you want to do about it? How do you want to regulate or transform economic activity, and according to what principles do you want to regulate activity? It was forced to answer this question by its very success. And not immediately after Seattle, but sometime after Seattle, these questions began to appear on the scene. In the movement. Do you all remember when they began to appear? Not so much. Okay. Well, that's my argument nonetheless. okay. anyway. Switching gears here.
All right.
In any case, unfortunately, the movement, in my opinion, failed to clearly answer these questions about what type of alternative it wanted to build. It failed to answer these questions when they arose and when it was in the center of the political stage and when the world was asking it to clarify its aims. You know, journalist after journalist was going into the movement saying, what are you for? What do you believe in? And people were wanting to know, what the fuck do you believe in? I remember my family, my mom's from Seattle, and they'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, like, what do you believe in? You know, you mean my family. They didn't say it like that, but... unfortunately, the problem was is that the discussions in movement circles were primarily about strategic and tactical issues, not about the fundamental political questions about how we're going to restructure economic and political activity. They were about, and also to some extent about moral issues. They were about tactical issues, such as the role of violence at protests. There's big debates about that. And also about moral issues, about the role of privilege, the impact of privilege on activists. Important questions, but nonetheless, a larger reconstructive vision was never really seriously debated or advanced, even if some schemes did float around the activist circles. And in my opinion, so I'm going to make a little bit of a critique, and I'm nearly done. The movement's emphasis on tactics and tactics instead of politics actually created a problem for it. The emphasis on tactics over politics allowed the movement to be broader and more expansive than it would have been otherwise, because people from a variety of different tendencies can agree on the need to participate in direct action. Good. You can be a communist, a Marxist, or a liberal, you know, and still support the right and the utility of protest. However, it also tended to encourage a political culture that undermined attempts to respond to the political questions. For example, the emphasis on diversity and plurality, which are certainly good things, are things that I support, tended to encourage all people to also accept contradictory aims, contradictory political aims. And in my opinion, the contradiction between those who want to regulate, use the state to regulate capital, and those who want to abolish capital in the state was never really fully addressed. People tended to be too tolerant of contradictory political aims. And I don't mean to suggest that people should, you know, yell at one another, but political contradictions need to be addressed. And I think a political culture had emerged within the movement that had encouraged a contradiction of political aims, or contradictory political aims. And even some people argued that presenting affirmative, coherent alternatives is in of itself repressive. So there were some problems, I think, in the culture that the movement had developed that made it difficult for us to address some of the really key political questions that we needed to address, in my opinion. And I think the movement began to productively wrestle with these questions in the middle of 2001. I remember the discussions pretty distinctly. But then September, the terror attacks of September 11th occurred, and everything changed, in my opinion. The state asserted its full force through repression at home and war abroad. And the anti-globalization movement, in my opinion, which had always been ambiguous on the question of the state, was not in a good position to respond. There were people that wanted to use the state to regulate global capital. There were people who were against the state. There was a movement whose political culture mitigated against the forms of the state, but the issues weren't clear. And so I think it had a very difficult time responding. And although there have been important protests since then, important protests in Miami, important protests in Cancun, and a very important protest in New York against the World Economic Forum, and it was February 2002, right? In which the anti-globalization movement appeared on the scene and said, "Look, we're not going to be." It was in, you know, New York of all places. Said, "We're not going to be silenced. Your war against terrorism is not going to silence us. You're not going to silence dissent." So, although there have been some important protests since then, I think the last 2 years have been primarily a period of decline for the anti-globalization movement. I don't believe that the anti-war movement has really taken up the anti-globalization movement's decentralist and anti-capitalist themes, and I don't believe that the anti-globalization movement is as capable of stirring fear among elites in the way that it did previously. Like, for example, in Miami, I'm going over time. Right?
Yeah, we both did.
I'll just about done. I believe the protests in Miami were superseded by something that happened to do with Michael Jackson. There was some media thing, yeah. But not in Cancun, or maybe it was Cancun.
Michael Jackson was Miami.
And then, the protests in Cancun didn't, there's nowhere near the level of media attention that existed before. And I think the documentaries and book efforts to shape the movement internally, activist efforts to shape the movement internally, have ceased to appear as frequently as they did before. Things like indie media, which were innovations of the anti-globalization movement, are no longer innovations of that character appearing, or have not appeared recently. Books and documentaries on the movement appear much less frequently than they did before, And many of the vibrant discussions that occurred, particularly about violence and also privilege, have, I believe, primarily dried up. So just to conclude, I attribute the movement's dispersal primarily to its ability to clarify what it was for, and thus to develop a politics that could adapt to changing conditions. Had we advanced a clear vision of what we want to create, of what institutions we want to build, and how we want to restructure economic activity, particularly had we dealt with the issue of state power more clearly, had we done that, I think the movement might have been able to continue playing its transformative role. I think that would have been possible. But that didn't occur. And I believe that anti-authoritarians did a very good job at engaging the historical opening embodied by the anti-globalization movement. I think we deepened the radicalism of this particular conflict over capitalism in important ways, and I think that's something to be proud of. But I think that this particular moment in the history of capitalism has passed, and that new anti-capitalist resistance will occur on a new terrain. And this is okay. It's not a bad thing. Anti-capitalist movements like capitalism are not eternal, but rather are born one day, grow and develop, and then disappear as historical conditions change. Capitalism will disappear as well. And the goal of my talk is not to discourage people or to be a downer, but to encourage a sort of historical sensitivity that I think we're going to need to muster in order to make sure not only that our movements continue and adapt to changing historical conditions, but that we can build a movement that can one day allow us to forever relegate capitalism to the past. That's my goal. Thank you.
You're wrong. No, we both went over time so much that I think we should actually just go into discussion rather than do this kind of back and forth.
Yeah.
Piece. Does that sound right with folks? Okay. So if people don't want to be recorded if you came in later, just when you raise your hand to make a comment, do some kind of hand thing that says, no, I don't want to be recorded. All right, so people just kind of raise your hand and maybe say who you are and comment, question. If it is a question, though, it's a kind of group question. We're not experts on anything. So.
Sorry, I forgot your name.
Marina.
I'm more inclined to agree with your position, because I think just something that Chuck brought up that I found interesting was just the fact that the anti-globalization movement didn't articulate its goals in a very good way. But I also I thought it was interesting what you were bringing up about prefigurative politics, because I think that's one thing that a great thing that anarchists specifically brought into the anti-globalization movement was, within the actions themselves, bringing in the kind of values that we would want to see in a world we're creating. So you had things spokes council meetings and very horizontal organizing, and I think that in a sense was the articulation of what we wanted to see in society. Now, maybe the problem in that was that while that was certainly articulated within the movement itself, it certainly it probably didn't get out to the right-wing pundits and liberals who were pointing the fingers saying you guys are just crazy kids smashing windows, what do you want? So maybe I don't know, I'd like to throw that out and say in my perception, that's how people in the movement did articulate what we wanted.
That's a question too for Marina, because I guess, and I kind of I don't know if I would say it's dead or whether it's even a point in time, but as I look back in retrospect, I kind of see as these huge protests where a lot of people come out from all over the country and meet and do a lot of good things. But in my experience, because I've mainly spent around D.C. and I live in Baltimore, but then people come back and there's no real local discussion groups, and any affinity groups that were formed for the protest were formed for tactical reasons and how to evade the cops and what they're going to accomplish there. But then that doesn't carry over, actually. People don't get together and discuss their visions and things like that. But have you seen that? Do you see that growing? Or because of, as I see, it's kind of like these spokes councils, it's such a small population of people that actually participate, and then just mass people show up to the protest, that I see definitely the ideas are there, but I just don't know how many people are actually really plugging into that horizontal decision making. And I just wonder if you had you know, other experiences or seen things grow, because I see a lot of people kind of jump onto these things or there, but then they go home and they forget about it, and it's like,
I mean, I definitely have some things to share. I don't know if other folks do as well, so rather than dominating too much space, but just thinking immediately of D.C. and Baltimore, I mean, it's a dynamic, and it's not that you form a group and it gets larger and larger and larger and larger necessarily, that movements and groups kind of move in different ways. But I think there's an info shop starting in Baltimore, and that there's certain things where you can see certain kinds of spaces. I mean, I don't know your areas.
There is,
but
I know a lot more people would go to a protest in D.C. than ever even get involved with a local like group or even organizing on a local level. Right. So that's what I just kind of see as like...
Well, I think we should talk about it more, because I think for me it's not just the numbers of people who show up to one mobilization, but I think we can actually see it in all kinds of pockets all over in organizing. But if other people don't, eventually I'll come back and say something. But you have...
Yeah, just to go off of that, I think it's changing where more and more people are starting to realize that that is a dead end, just going from protest to protest. That's not going to take us anywhere different. And maybe it's just the people that I'm talking to and the stuff I'm reading, but it really seems like there's a shift towards thinking, how can we take this back? How can we do this every day, every week?
There's a lot of food for thought from your presentations, which I really appreciate. I'm not sure if what I'm going to say is going to make sense, because there's so much. But I find myself agreeing more with Marina than with Chuck, and disagreeing more with Chuck. But the premise of the debate is also problematic for me, because the term anti-globalization movement's always been problematic, and you allude to that as well. Using Seattle as a starting point, you allude to that as well. But if we're going to look at it in a truly global sense, as internationalists, as a truly global justice movement, then... You know, not only did it not start in Chiapas, but, you know, there are other reference points, globally speaking, if you go beyond the North American-centered way of looking at things. Manila 96, IMF riots throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, those movements are still very vibrant. And I just think we have to add that to our discourse and our conversation when we talk about this, because Seattle's misleading, although it is useful enough. So I'll start at Seattle, too, if we're gonna do that, because... there were, of course, many debates. I think the term anti-globalization in French, actually the term that's being used now is, the equivalent of anti-globalization is anti-mondialisation, but now we use the term alter-mondialisation, right, which really doesn't have an equivalent, which means alternative globalization, which actually does a lot of respect to the movement. Because what anti-globalization basically is sort of an umbrella for all kinds of things. And the anti-authoritarian anarchist element was one part of that, but there's always these tensions, always. And I found a lot of, I mean, I was at the RAC conference back in 2001, before September 11th, if I remember, but after Quebec City, and a lot of the people were glorifying the anti-globalization movement as some sort of anarchist thing, an anti-authoritarian thing. And if you're in the midst of the debates, in the midst of the organizing, we're a part of it, absolutely. A lot of the things that we contribute to it are being taken up, but we're fighting against statists, we're fighting against reformists, we're fighting on a whole bunch of levels. So that sort of was fudged by using this term anti-globalization. A lot of people seeing that as equivalent as anarchists. But from Seattle, the debate started right away about rooting our resistance. That was expressed in a lot of different ways. You kind of alluded to it, Chuck, when you talked about privilege, but you call it a moral argument. But it was more than that, I think. It was about rooting resistance in our communities. And, for example, people from OCAP in Toronto talked about how, you know, thousands of activists from Toronto would get on a bus, and the way they expressed it was like walk over the homeless guy that lived in their city to get on a bus to go 4 hours to Quebec City. And I think there's a reflection of trying to root that resistance in the way of how a lot of movements have transformed themselves and have made a turn towards the local. So I see sort of this local pull of organizing in our communities. And when I say that, I mean we have to bring in class dimensions and race dimensions, communities of resistance that have resisted by virtue of who they are. So, I mean, root cause is an example of that kind of uniting with the anti-globalization movement that's been alluded to. But there's the local, then there's the global, which I'm trying to get to, which is that let's look at it on a global level. And Seattle is a very minor sort of, for us maybe not, but it's a minor part of this global resistance. But between the local and that global, you know, giving props to the third world and dealing with what happens in our communities, between that, there's the protests, and that's what I think we're to end up talking about, Cancun, Miami, and they're useful reference points, but struggle is so much more than that, and that's sort of the critique that was being brought forward. So just to address a couple of things that Chuck said, you know, that we sort of missed our moment to articulate vision. I think people were articulating the vision within that struggle. So when that question was asked, what are you for? I mean, I think a lot of people had answers for that. Not the vision, but saying our answer of what are we for comes out of those struggles. Just to give one example, Palestine, which a lot of people in the anti-globalization movement, to use that really crude term, took to heart. Because what you were for had to be defined in terms of what you were fighting against. And it's sort of a whole different vision of struggle. I'm not sure if I'm making sense there, but tactics versus politics, the whole tactical argument was about giving space to the ways in which those movements in the South have resisted. So at the Cochabamba conference of the PGA, changes were made to using the word nonviolence, talking about histories of struggle. You talked about historical sensitivity, and that's of course really important, but I think there's also contemporary sensitivity about what's happening now, and maybe acknowledging that those movements are still there, but they're, I mean, just to give one example, in Montreal, of CLAC, which was a group that, you know, was sort of archetypical anti-globalization group, but sort of reformed itself on local struggles, housing, immigrant and refugee rights, and still try to have analysis that confronts these institutions. So I'm not sure if any of that, you know, sort of is an argument. These are sort of things that I end up reacting to. And the final thing is about Chiapas. You mentioned that it wasn't transplanted. In a very tangible way, it was transplanted in Canada. Seattle's sort of the symbolic starting point for anti-globalization in the U.S., but Vancouver in 97, I'm not sure if other Canadians here would agree, but what happened in Vancouver in 97 with APEC was sort of a starting point there. And really tangibly, there were activists who came back from the International Pope, I think they called it, back in 96. And what the Zapatistas, or at least what was being articulated there, were saying was, bring back this international to where you live, in your community. Confront those institutions where you are. And that was very clear. And I'm pretty sure that there was a similar process in different ways all over the world, especially in France and Italy, places where the Zapatista solidarity movement has a lot of strength. I've sort of spoken all already, so I'll just leave it at that. Just some thoughts, food for thought.
I think that this is a movement of movements. We are not the only movement, and we cannot measure other movements according to the relationship or what they have in common with us or what they don't have in common with us. I think that the Zapatista experience particularly was really transplanted everywhere, and our movement is deeply, deeply we owe them a lot. When we think of the way we organize, when we think of what the little vision that we have for the future and that we've been able to articulate is very much influenced by the Zapatista movement, as was the movement in Argentina, as I think sort of is also the movement in South Africa probably, and I don't know much about India, but I think that was the one experience in the last 20 years that really, really influenced other movements. Now, if you're going to talk about transplanting the way we used to understand it in the 70s, no, it wasn't transplanted in the way that Che Guevara's theories were transplanted. But that's the kind of thing that we are avoiding nowadays, I think. So I think it was transplanted in the only sane way that movement experiences can be transplanted. Maybe in the same way that the struggles in Argentina, somehow we were able to convey this idea of how do we meet, how do we discuss, are we interested in hierarchy, are we interested in horizontalism. But I do think that every one of these movements has particular things that are only particular to them, like what you were explaining. Well, what do we find in the anti-globalization movement that we only find there? And we can find that kind of characteristics everywhere. And it's natural that we will find them, because what we call today the anti-globalization movement is a movement that is mainly what we think of what's going on in the industrialized nations. So in no way can we expect what they are fighting against to be the same things that we are fighting against in Argentina or in other underdeveloped nations or whatever you want to call them. But what I don't agree is with this idea that these movements in Chiapas or in Argentina were mainly against their own state. I very, very much disagree with that. I think that the first political and public manifestation of Zapatismo was against NAFTA. It wasn't against the Mexican state. And when you look at the struggles in Argentina, nobody's an idiot. Of course, they were against the government, and people didn't give up until five different presidents fell. But the main devilish character of those struggles was the IMF. And you can ask anybody in Argentina, from the first person to the last one, what the IMF is, and they're going to give you a very accurate explanation of what it is. In these countries, we don't needed Seattle to tell us what the international institutions were, because we were suffering them from the 70s on and maybe earlier. So, of course, its movements are different, but I think we all confront the same enemy, and it's very, very premature to say if they are alive or dead. I think they're obviously alive because we are sitting here talking about them, and we're going to get out of here and we are going to organize in our own communities, very much influenced by the kind of politics that we develop when we get together in this big protest. So, yeah, those were the things I wanted to point out.
Okay. Is it okay to wait a second and he'll respond? Is that okay?
Been a lot of comments, criticism, critical of my views, which I certainly appreciate and respect. I want to make, I'll be really brief. I want to make one point, is regarding something that you said about the Zapatistas and the movements in Argentina, as I see it, the Zapatistas were against the Mexican government's institutional acceptance of NAFTA, and they mobilized and they demanded that they demanded a lot of things, but it was not just NAFTA per se, but the Mexican government's acceptance, signing of NAFTA on January 1st, 19.
It was the day that the agreement was put
in force.
Put in force.
Yeah. So I would cast it a little differently, not just against NAFTA. The other thing I wanted to say, the same thing in Argentina. I believe that the movements were fighting for the state not to honor its obligations to the IMF, not fighting the IMF per se direct so much as fighting for the state to not honor its agreements with the IMF. And whether I'm wrong or right about that, I just want to be clear about the distinction. And the other point I wanted to make was... I'll leave it at that. I just want to clarify those points. I'll let other people speak.